Hello and welcome to Uncovering Family History, a weekly podcast sharing the stories discovered through family history research. The highs, the lows, the exciting, and even the mundane. Not only are we sharing stories, but also research tips picked up along the way that could help you with your research going forward. I love hearing about the stories that others have found in their family trees and the types of records they've managed to uncover during their research. So I wanted to do something that would not only allow me to talk about my ancestors and their stories, but also get to learn about other people's stories as well. And in the grand scheme of things, maybe connect people with similar research interests. Once again this week, I'm flying solo, not only sharing some of my must-search record databases, but also diving into another story from my family tree. This story is one I know a lot of Australians have in their own family trees, and while there are some people who still don't talk about the skeletons in the closet, there are many, like myself, who love having this connection to a pivotal moment in British and Australian history. I'm sure you can guess what I'm referring to, but I'll dive into that more later in the episode. If you've taken a moment to stalk my blog, as recommended in the previous episode, you'll probably be familiar with the recommendations I'm about to make. If not, then get some pen and paper ready to jot down some research locations you need to be hitting if you haven't already. A lot of these are Australian-based, which is perfect if, like me, you are Australian or have Australians lurking in your tree. But you'll no doubt have similar databases in your country or the country you are looking to search in. Of course, they may be a little harder to find or may not have a searchable index, but they are out there somewhere. My absolute go-to database is Trove. Run by the National Library of Australia, it's an absolutely amazing archive of Australian newspapers that are keyword searchable and can be saved and downloaded for your own records. The most amazing thing is that it's 100% free. There's no sign-up fee, there's no fee to access each individual newspaper, and no fee if you want to download and print a copy. It's absolutely amazing. Newspapers are constantly being digitized, and while the newspapers of interest to you might not be available yet, they will be eventually. Because we are so spoilt here in Australia, I always struggle with attempts to search overseas in New Zealand and the UK, where the databases seem more difficult to search or require paid memberships for access. And I think it's also in part because some of my family have very generic and common names, meaning it's so difficult to figure out if the person you're searching for and have information come up about is the person that you're meant to be searching for. It's all very confusing. I could honestly gush about Trove all day, so if you want to know more of my thoughts, then definitely get in touch. A big, big must is birth, deaths, and marriages. In Australia, every state has their own registry service, and they all have family history sections dedicated to the search of old records and the purchasing of certificate copies. My research has really only seen me utilise the New South Wales and Victorian registries, and while I've not purchased the certificates for every single one of my ancestors, because that would be way too expensive, the basic information provided in the index can be sufficient enough for those ancestors more further afield. It is important to note, however, that there are restrictions on when these records are released. In Victoria, for example, births are after 100 years, deaths after 30 years, and marriages after 60 years. And that's literally to the day. I could search for my ancestor born 100 years ago yesterday and have the record pop up. My third and final recommendation for today is Find a Grave, which is something that those of you outside of Australia will definitely be able to access and use. This is a community-contributed database for burials all over the world. We'd all love to track down and visit the graves of our ancestors, but sometimes that's just not possible. Particularly now we're in a global pandemic, as I don't think exploring cemeteries for family history research is considered an important travel reason. But you never know. So, Find a Grave allows you to digitally visit the grave, see what it looks like, where it's located, and what the headstone says. Find a Grave is actually connected to Ancestry, so you've probably had hints pop up for your ancestors linking you to the website. One thing I cannot stress enough is taking the time to add any burials that you visited in person, whether it be adding the whole burial listing or just adding a photo to a listing that has already been made. You can also volunteer to help transcribe headstone engravings and to actually take photos that have been requested of burials that don't have photos on them yet. It is such an awesome community to be involved with, and the website itself is such an amazing resource, but it's only like that because of everyone in the community adding to it. So if you can contribute in some way, shape or form, as small as it could be, it can be really helpful. There are, of course, more database recommendations, but I'll save them for down the track. If you can't wait until a future episode, go check out my blog, particularly if you are Australian or are doing Australian research. Speaking of Australia, let's dive into my next story, which takes us all the way back to the foundation of White Australia and the arrival of convict settlers. This is obviously a pretty divisive time in Australian history, and while I don't condone the extremely dark period of history that colonisation brought with it and the absolutely abhorrent treatment of First Nation peoples that inhabited this land and the repercussions that are still being felt today, I don't want to hide or feel ashamed to have convict ancestors. I can't apologise for what my ancestors did and what they were a part of, but I can work to better educate myself and those around me now and be part of the voice trying to change current issues that our First Nation peoples face. There are quite a few convicts dotted through my family tree, and oddly enough, they all seem to be on my paternal grandmother's side of the family, which honestly explains so much about my father's side of the family, although I obviously can't talk because they're my family, and my mother's side of the family also has some questionable people, as shown in the previous episode. For this episode, however, I'll just be focusing on Thomas Gosper and Mary Hipwell, who arrived on the 2nd and 3rd fleets respectively. However, before diving into their stories, let me share a little bit of backstory as to why convicts were transported to Australia in the first place. With the loss of the American colonies due to the War of Independence in the 1770s and 1780s, Britain lost its ability to transport convicts. It is estimated that upwards of 50,000 convict men had been transported to the Americas in the 60 years prior to the War of Independence. Suddenly, that option wasn't available, and between 1782 and 1787, the prison population of Britain had doubled, leading to mass overcrowding and the threat of the spread of disease. The government was in dire need of a solution to the ever-growing prisoner problem, and so sought to find locations to transport convicts. Several options, from resuming transportation to Maryland or commencing transportation to its other colonies like Jamaica and Nova Scotia, to creating a settlement in the Falklands, River Gambier or the Das Volta's coast, were turned down. Existing colonies didn't want to take convicts, and new settlement locations were deemed inhospitable. After several years of receiving proposals for transportation from Joseph Banks, James Matra, John Call, and Sir George Young, who all spoke favourably of Botany Bay, the convict problem finally had a solution, creating a penal settlement on the east coast of Australia where Captain James Cook had sailed 15 years prior. Remember that time frame, by the way? 15 years. The rationale for the choice of Botany Bay is outlined in the Heads of a Plan document, which was sent from Lord Sydney to the Treasury. Over 15 paragraphs, the document explains why Botany Bay had been chosen and the plan for convict settlement, from how many convicts and marines would be taken on the journey to the types of tools and provisions that would be required. These points indicated just how self-sufficient the new colony settlement would need to be, with the ships to take as many, quote, provisions as they can possibly stow, or at least a sufficient quantity for 2 years' consumption. It is presumed the colony will be fully sufficient for their manufacture and support, end quote. Unfortunately, due to no one having seen Botany Bay in 15 years, they had no idea just how harsh the conditions would be for those arriving on the First Fleet, resulting in limited rations and near starvation by the time the 2nd and 3rd fleets arrived in 1789 and 1791 respectively. Not to mention, thanks to Cook's passing remarks, no one knew that the indigenous population was much larger than expected and wouldn't bow under the pressure of white colonists trying to steal their land. The heads of the plan also alludes to ulterior motives when it comes to the choice of Australia as a new colony. The final three paragraphs refer to flax, tropical products, and New Zealand timber, with reference to the quote, considerable advantage that will arise from the cultivation of the New Zealand hemp or flax plant, end quote, in regards to naval supply. It also mentions the hopes that, quote, Asiatic productions could be cultivated in the new settlement, as well as the possibility of procuring from New Zealand any quantity of masks and ship timber, end quote, again for the benefit of the Navy. It is these three short paragraphs that have suggested to some historians that the British government was establishing more than just a criminal outpost, and that convict transportation was just a front to the expansion of the empire. For England, Australia became its most important convict outpost, with an estimated 162,000 convicts being transported between 1788 and 1868, three times the amount that was sent to the Americas. So, now that we've established a little context as to why criminals needed to be transported halfway around the world in the first place, let's dive into my criminals. We start with Thomas Roker Alexander Gosper, my fifth great-grandfather, born the 10th of May 1768 in Surrey, England, to parents Thomas Roker Gosper and Jane Wharton. The family lived in Rotherhithe in southeast London, an area known in the 18th century to house the city's poorest citizens. The wealth and status of the family are further cemented by the fact that neither Thomas nor his parents could read or write. Situated on the River Thames, Rotherhithe was part of London's docklands. Thomas worked on the docks as a lighterman, putting him in the perfect position for the crime which he was to commit. On the 23rd of November 1786, Thomas, along with Thomas Gaskin and William Stewart, were caught damaging the property of Edward Thomas and James Ogle. Appearing in the Surrey Assizes on the 2nd of April 1787, they were officially charged with, quote, feloniously cutting, damaging and spoiling at Rotherhithe a headfast affixed to a certain vessel called a lighter, end quote. In layman's terms, they cut three pieces of rope to the value of 20 shillings that were attached to a boat. Seems like a pretty small crime, but it was actually very common practice. Someone would cut the rope of a moored boat at night, waiting for it to drift downstream where it would then be looted. But essentially, Thomas was sentenced to 7 years transportation to the colonies for cutting a few pieces of rope. Thomas embarked on the ship's prize as part of the Second Fleet on the 19th of January 1790. The Second Fleet consisted of six ships, Lady Julianne, Guardian, Surprise, Neptune, Scarborough, and storeship Justine, with Surprise being the smallest of the fleet. The Second Fleet suffered badly on their 158 to 306-day journey from Portsmouth to Port Jackson, with the Guardian actually hitting ice near the Cape of Good Hope and becoming wrecked on the coast. The voyage saw the highest mortality rate in the history of transportation to New South Wales. On the Surprise alone, 254 men boarded in England and only 218 disembarked in Sydney. The rough seas saw the ship constantly taking on water, sometimes above the convict's waist, throughout the 158-day journey. The recounts of the journey show that the journey itself would have been punishment enough, but Thomas still had 7 years of convict service to contend with once he stepped foot on land on the 26th of June 1790. Before we get any further into Thomas's life in the colony, let's backtrack a little and turn our focus onto Mary Ann Hipwell, who was born in 1765. Not too much is known about Mary prior to 1790, when she first appeared in the London Times for committing the crime that would see her shipped off to the colonies. Mary lived in Hanover Square, working as a servant for Mrs. Elizabeth Tyndale. At the beginning of August 1790, Elizabeth left her house in the care of Mary, telling her not to abandon her post or admit any men. Guess what happened? On the 14th, Elizabeth received word that her house had been robbed 2 nights prior, while Mary had gone to Sadler's Wells with a Benjamin Colburn. Elizabeth returned home to find upwards of £200 of property missing in the form of apparel, plates and jewellery, with the cost to replace being much higher. Between the many contradictions in the story and Colburn's general character, both Mary and Benjamin were committed to trial, which took place in October. The London Times from the 28th of October 1790 reported the following. Quote, before Mr. Justice Heath, Benjamin Colburn and Mary Hipwell were indicted for stealing wearing apparel, plate and jewels to a great amount, the property of Elizabeth Tyndale in her dwelling house. Mrs. Tyndale said she lived in Bolton Street, Piccadilly, that on the 2nd of August she went into the country and left her house in town in charge of Mary Hipwell. On the 9th of August, she received a letter from Mr. McKay that her house was robbed. When she came to town, she found all the property gone that was shared in the indictment. An officer searched Mary Hipwell's box and found in it a pair of new gloves, which Mrs. Tyndale positively swore to be her property. There was also a pillowcase found in the box, which she believed to be her property, but could not swear positively to it, as it had no mark upon it. The jury found Mary Hipwell guilty of stealing goods to the value of 1 shilling. There was no evidence whatsoever against Colburn. He was taken up merely on suspicion, having kept company with Hipwell, not guilty. End quote. Mary was sentenced to 7 years transportation to the colonies for a crime that she may or may not have actually committed. And although Benjamin was found not guilty, he did eventually find himself bound for the colonies too. I don't know what he eventually did to get shipped off since I've not actually looked into it. But I'm kind of glad that karma bit him in the ass at some point. Mary, fittingly, embarked on the ship Mary Ann as part of the Third Fleet on the 16th of February 1791. The Third Fleet consisted of 11 ships, Mary Ann, HMS Gordon, Matilda, Atlantic, Salamander, William and Anne, Active, Queen, Albemarle, Britannia, and Admiral Barrington. The Mary Ann was the only ship to transport solely female convicts, although a small number of females were also aboard Queen. Surprisingly, 6 female convicts mysteriously wound up on Albemarle, despite none embarking when the ship left England. Compared to the voyage of the Second Fleet, the Third Fleet travelled a lot better, with only 9 dying aboard the Mary Ann and 182 deaths total, compared to the 273 total deaths in the Second Fleet. The journey was hardly an improvement, however, with conditions said to be cramped and unhygienic, with convicts surviving on little more than starvation rations. After 143 days at sea, Mary arrived at Port Jackson on the 9th of July 1791, ready to start her 7-year sentence. Thomas first appears in colonial records in November 1794, when he was granted 30 acres of land on the western bank of the Hawkesbury River, opposite what is now Windsor. From his very poor and uneducated upbringing in Rotherhithe, where he worked on the docks, Thomas had become a relatively skilled farmer, eventually becoming a respected member of the community. During this time, Mary became involved with fellow Third Fleet convict Richard Reynolds, who arrived on the Atlantic on the 20th of August 1791. They had a child, Edward, in 1794, and eventually moved to the Hawkesbury. By 1798, however, Mary had moved on from Richard, bringing Edward with her as she moved in with Thomas in Freeman's Reach. Together, Thomas and Mary had 4 children, Thomas Jr. in 1798, John in 1801, Joseph in 1804, and James in 1805. I'm descended from their second child, John, who married Hannah Beale Reynolds in 1822 and had 13 children. And yes, in case you were wondering, Hannah is Richard Reynolds' daughter from his marriage to Sarah Elizabeth Stirling, another convict who arrived in 1798. Thomas's Hawkesbury land was heavily timbered, and by 1801 he had cleared all but 5 acres, most of it ploughed for wheat and maize. He had also acquired a goat and 8 pigs, managing to support himself, his family, and a female servant with just the government rations. Clearly, Thomas was doing well for himself and was in good standing within the colony because he was granted a further 100 acres in the district of Mulgrave in August 1803. He was reported by one government official as being deserving of the additional land because he was, quote, industrious. By all accounts, despite his reasons for being in New South Wales in the first place, Thomas was an upstanding member of the community who had carried out his sentence without much trouble. Although, I kind of wish he got up to trouble because he might have appeared in more records. During this time, Thomas and Mary had been living together and raising their family, but were not wed. In January 1810, Governor Lachlan Macquarie had taken over administration of the colony, bringing with him a change for colonial society. Emancipates were now encouraged to take their rightful place in the mainstream of society, and mistresses were encouraged to become wives. With this, Thomas and Mary were married at St. Matthew's Church of England in Windsor on the 19th of November 1810, 7 weeks after Thomas's Certificate of Freedom was granted on the 29th of September 1810. It would seem, if you were the romantic type, that Thomas wanted to marry as a free man. The Gosper family went on to become a pretty respectable family within the Hawkesbury, Freeman's Reach and Upper Colo area, continuing to not only farm a mix of crop and livestock, but also able to lease chunks of land out. Records do indicate that Thomas did go through a rough patch, having to get at least 2 loans from the Bank of New South Wales, but overall, he was pretty darn good at what he was doing. Mary passed away at the age of 72 at Upper Colo on the 23rd of August 1837, 46 years after arriving in the colony. It also seems that the death of his wife had Thomas looking at his own mortality as he wrote his last will and testament on the 20th of September 1837, bequeathing portions of land to all his sons to be handed down the male line of the family. And I'm a bit annoyed because I could have inherited some good land, maybe. Probably not, but that's not the point. Thomas then passed away at the age of 79, also at Upper Colo, on the 21st of September 1847, 57 years after his frightful voyage to the colony. Both Mary and Thomas were buried in the Colo Valley, but the exact location is not known, and the only record of their deaths comes from the family Bible held by Joseph. As of 1998, according to the book Gosper Connections, A Genealogy of Thomas Roker, Alexander Gosper and Mary Ann Hipwell, which is an amazing book by the way, there were at least 24,700 descendants of Thomas and Mary, which broke down into 12,656 males and 12,044 females. And I'm one of them. Well, I don't think I was included in that number because I wasn't in the book, but still. It's one thing to have a vague notion that there are a lot of distant relatives out there, but it's a whole other thing to have a ballpark number that has only increased in the past 23 years. So a life sentence of being sent away thousands of miles for the smallest of crimes. And while a lot of convicts were shipped off after a series of small crimes, it seems that neither Thomas nor Mary had any prior convictions, as they didn't seem to play any sort of role into the reporting of their actual conviction. Did they deserve the torment of the journey and the grueling early years of the colony? Probably not. But if they hadn't been sent to Australia, I wouldn't be here, so clearly wasn't all that bad. If you want to read about more stories which will actually be told in future episodes or check out some other family history related content, then make sure you check out my blog. I have a few posts looking at the different research databases you should be checking out, as well as sharing how I've organized my physical tree collection. Plus, if you head over to my shop page, you'll find some genealogy document bundles available to help in your research and recording. And if you're interested in getting involved in the podcast and having a chat with me and sharing a story or two from your own ancestry, then be sure to fill out the form linked in the episode and show notes. I honestly cannot wait to hear about what interesting stories you've been able to uncover in your research. Make sure you subscribe on your podcast platform of choice and follow me on social media to stay in the loop about new episodes and ways to get involved. Until next week, happy researching.